Chapter 18. Night of a possible war. For the next 2 days I went about amongst my fellow men, who welcomed me with the utmost consideration and friendliness, but unanimously derided my fears of a war. They would not believe in it. It was impossible. On the evening of the second day I was in the hotel smoking room, an irrationally private apartment, a sanctuary for a few choice minds of the town. All was pervaded by a dim religious light, and more hushed than any club reading room I have ever been in. Gathered into a small knot, we were discussing the situation in subdued tones suitable to the genius of the place. A gentleman with a fine head of white hair suddenly pointed an impatient finger in my direction and apostrophized me. What I want to know is whether, should there be war, England would come in. The time to draw a breath, and I spoke out for the cabinet without faltering. Most assuredly. I should think all Europe knows that by this time. He took hold of the lapel of my coat, and, giving it a slight jerk for greater emphasis, said forcibly, "Then, if England will, as you say, and all the world knows it, there can be no war. Germany won't be so mad as that." On the morrow by noon we read of the German ultimatum. The day after came the declaration of war, and the Austrian mobilization order. We were fairly caught. All that remained for me to do was to get my party out of the way of eventual shells. The best move which occurred to me was to snatch them up instantly into the mountains to a Polish health resort of great repute, which I did at the rate of 100 miles in 11 hours, by the last civilian train permitted to leave Krakow for the next 3 weeks. And there we remained amongst the Poles from all parts of Poland, not officially interned, but simply unable to obtain the permission to travel by train, or road. It was a wonderful, a poignant 2 months. This is not the time, and, perhaps, not the place, to enlarge upon the tragic character of the situation. A whole people seeing the culmination of its misfortunes, in a final catastrophe, unable to trust anyone, to appeal to anyone, to look for help from any quarter, deprived of all hope, and even of its last illusions, and unable, in the trouble of minds and the unrest of consciences, to take refuge in stoical acceptance. I have seen all this, and I am glad I have. Not so many years left me to remember that appalling feeling of inexorable fate, tangible, palpable, come after so many cruel years, a figure of dread, murmuring with iron lips the final words, ruin and extinction. But enough of this. For our little band there was the awful anguish of incertitude as to the real nature of events in the West. It is difficult to give an idea how ugly and dangerous things look to us over there. Belgium knocked down and trampled out of existence, France giving in under repeated blows, a military collapse like that of 1870 and England involved in that disastrous alliance, her army sacrificed, her people in a panic. Polish papers, of course, had no other but German sources of information. Naturally, we did not believe all we read, but it was sometimes excessively difficult to react with sufficient firmness. We used to shut our door, and there, away from everybody, we sat weighing the news, hunting up discrepancies, scenting lies, finding reasons for hopefulness, and generally cheering each other up. But it was a beastly time. People used to come to me with very serious news and ask, "What do you think of it?" And my invariable answer was, "Whatever has happened, or is going to happen, whoever wants to make peace, you may be certain that England will not make it, not for 10 years, if necessary." ... But enough of this too. Through the unremitting efforts of Polish friends we obtained at last the permission to travel to Vienna. Once there, the wing of the American Eagle was extended over our uneasy heads. We cannot be sufficiently grateful to the American ambassador who, all along, interested himself in our fate, for his exertions on our behalf, his invaluable assistance and the real friendliness of his reception in Vienna. Owing to Mr. Penfield's action we obtained the permission to leave Austria. and it was a near thing, for His Excellency has informed my American publishers, since that a week later orders were issued two of us detained till the end of the war. However, we effected our hair's breadth escape into Italy, and, reaching Genoa, took passage in a Dutch mail steamer, homeward bound from Java with London as a port of call. On that sea route I might have picked up a memory at every mile, if the past had not been eclipsed by the tremendous actuality. We saw the signs of it in the emptiness of the Mediterranean, the aspect of Gibraltar, the misty glimpse in the Bay of Biscay of an outward-bound convoy of transports, in the presence of British submarines in the channel. Innumerable drifters flying the naval flag dotted the narrow waters, and two naval officers coming on board off the south for land, piloted the ship through the Downs. The Downs. There they were, thick with the memories of my sea life. But what were to me now the futilities of an individual past? As our ship's head swung into the estuary of the Thames, a deep, yet faint, concussion passed through the air, a shock rather than a sound, which missing my ear found its way straight into my heart. Turning instinctively to look at my boys, I happened to meet my wife's eyes. She also had felt profoundly, coming from far away across the gray distances of the sea, the faint boom of the big guns at work on the coast of Flanders shaping the future. First News 1918. 4 years ago, on the first day of August, in the town of Krakow, Austrian Poland, nobody would believe that the war was coming. My apprehensions were met by the words. I have had these scares before. This incredulity was so universal amongst people of intelligence and information, that even I, who had accustomed myself to look at the inevitable 4 years past, felt my conviction shaken. At that time, it must be noted, the Austrian army was already partly mobilized, and as we came through Austrian Silesia we had noticed all the bridges being guarded by soldiers. Austria will back down, was the opinion of all the well-informed men with whom I talked on the 1st of August. The session of the university was ended and the students were either all gone, or going home to different parts of Poland. But the professors had not all departed yet on their respective holidays, and amongst them the tone of skepticism prevailed generally. Upon the whole there was very little inclination to talk about the possibility of a war. Nationally, the Poles felt that from their point of view there was nothing to hope from it. "Whatever happens," said a very distinguished man to me, "we may be certain that it's our skins which will pay for it as usual." A well-known literary critic and writer on economical subjects said to me, "R seems a material impossibility, precisely because it would mean the complete ruin of all material interests." He was wrong, as we know, but those who said that Austria as usual would back down were, as a matter of fact, perfectly right. Austria did back down. What these men did not foresee was the interference of Germany. And one cannot blame them very well, for who could guess that, when the balance stood even, the German sword would be thrown into the scale with nothing in the open political situation to justify that act, or rather that crime, if crime can ever be justified. For, as the same intelligent man said to me, "Yes it is, those people, meaning Germans, have very nearly the whole world in their economic grip. Their prestige is even greater than their actual strength. It can get for them practically everything they want. Then why risk it?" And there was no apparent answer to the question put in that way. I must also say that the Poles had no illusions about the strength of Russia. Those illusions were the monopoly of the Western world. Next day the librarian of the university invited me to come and have a look at the library which I had not seen since I was 14 years old. It was from him that I learned that the greater part of my father's MSS was preserved there. He confessed that he had not looked them through thoroughly yet, but he told me that there was a lot of very important letters bearing on the epoch from 60 to 63 to and from many prominent Poles of that time. And he added, "Here is a bundle of correspondence that will appeal to you personally. Those are letters written by your father to an intimate friend in whose papers they were found. They contain many references to yourself, though you couldn't have been more than 4 years old at the time. Your father seems to have been extremely interested in his son. That afternoon I went to the university, taking with me my eldest son. The attention of that young Englishman was mainly attracted by some relics of Copernicus in a glass case. I saw the bundle of letters, and accepted the kind proposal of the librarian, that he should have them copied for me during the holidays. In the range of the deserted vaulted rooms lined with books, full of August memories, and in the passionless silence of all this enshrined wisdom, we walked here and there talking of the past, the great historical past in which lived the inextinguishable spark of national life. And all around us the centuries-old buildings lay still and empty, composing themselves to rest after a year of work on the minds of another generation. No echo of the German ultimatum to Russia penetrated that academical peace. But the news had come. When we stepped into the street out of the deserted main quadrangle, we three, I imagine, were the only people in the town who did not know of it. My boy and I parted from the librarian, who hurried home, to pack up for his holiday, and walked on to the hotel, where we found my wife actually in the car waiting for us to take a run of some 10 miles to the country house of an old school friend of mine. He had been my greatest chum. In my wanderings about the world I had heard that his later career both at school and at the university had been of extraordinary brilliance in classics, I believe. But in this, the iron-gray mustache period of his life, he informed me with badly concealed pride that he had gained world fame as the inventor. No, inventor is not the word, producer, I believe, would be the right term of a wonderful kind of beetroot seed. The beet grown from this seed contained more sugar to the square inch, or was it to the square root, than any other kind of beet. He exported this seed, not only with profit and even to the United States, but with a certain amount of glory which seemed to have gone slightly to his head. There is a fundamental strain of agriculturalist in a pole which no amount of brilliance, even classical, can destroy. While we were having tea outside, looking down the lovely slope of the gardens at the view of the city in the distance, the possibilities of the war faded from our minds. Suddenly my friend's wife came to us with a telegram in her hand and said calmly, "Enroll mobilization, do you know?" We looked at her like men aroused from a dream. "Yes," she insisted, "they are already taking the horses out of the plows and carts." I said, "He had better go back to town as quick as we can," and my friend assented with a troubled look. "Yes, you had better." As we passed through villages on our way back, we saw mobs of horses assembled on the commons with soldiers guarding them, and groups of villagers looking on silently at the officers with their notebooks checking deliveries and writing out receipts. Some old peasant women were already weeping aloud. When our car drew up at the door of the hotel, the manager himself came to help my wife out. In the first moment I did not quite recognize him. His luxuriant black locks were gone, his head was closely cropped, and as I glanced at it, he smiled and said, "She'll sleep at the barracks tonight." I cannot reproduce the atmosphere of that night, the first night after mobilization. The shops and the gateways of the houses were of course closed, but all through the dark hours the town hummed with voices. The echoes of distant shouts entered the open windows of our bedroom. Groups of men talking noisily walked in the middle of the roadway escorted by distressed women. Men of all callings, and of all classes going, to report themselves at the fortress. Now and then a military car tooting furiously would whisk through the streets empty of wheeled traffic, like an intensely black shadow under the great flood of electric lights on the gray pavement. But what produced the greatest impression on my mind was a gathering at night in the coffee room of my hotel of a few men of mark whom I was asked to join. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning. The shutters were up. For some reason or other, the electric light was not switched on, and the big room was lit up only by a few tall candles, just enough for us to see each other's faces by. I saw in those faces the awful desolation of men whose country, torn in three, found itself engaged in the contest with no will of its own, and not even the power, to assert itself at the cost of life. All the past was gone, and there was no future, whatever happened. No road which did not seem to lead to moral annihilation. I remember one of those men addressing me after a period of mournful silence compounded of mental exhaustion and unexpressed forebodings. What do you think England will do? If there is a ray of hope anywhere, it is only there. I said, believe I know what England will do. This was before the news of the violation of Belgian neutrality arrived, though I won't tell you, for I am not absolutely certain. But I can tell you what I am absolutely certain of. It is this. If England comes into the war, then, no matter who may want to make peace at the end of 6 months at the cost of right and justice, England will keep on fighting for years if necessary. You may reckon on that. What, even alone? Asked somebody across the room. I said, yes, even alone. But if things go so far as that, England will not be alone. I think that at that moment I must have been inspired. Well done, 1918. It can be safely said, that for the last 4 years the seamen of Great Britain have done well. I mean that every kind and sort of human being classified as seaman, steward, foremast hand, fireman, lamp trimmer, mate, master, engineer, and also all through the innumerable ratings of the Navy up to that of Admiral, has done well. I don't say marvelously well or miraculously well or wonderfully well, or even very well, because these are simply overstatements of undisciplined minds. I don't deny that a man may be a marvelous being, but this is not likely to be discovered in his lifetime, and not always, even after he is dead. Man's marvelousness is a hidden thing, because the secrets of his heart are not to be read by his fellows. As to a man's work, if it is done well, it is the very utmost that can be said. You can do well, and you can do no more for people to see. In the Navy, where human values are thoroughly understood, the highest signal of commendation complimenting a ship, that is, a ship's company, on some achievements consists exactly of those two simple words, well done, followed by the name of the ship. Not marvelously done, astonishingly done, wonderfully done, no, only just. Well done, so and so. And to the men it is a matter of infinite pride, that somebody should judge it proper to mention aloud, as it were, that they have done well. It is a memorable occurrence, for in the sea services you are expected professionally and as a matter of course to do well, because nothing less will do. And in sober speech no man can. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.